Right now, it's been a busy week in Wisconsin news.
Wisconsin Attorney General Brad Schimmel announced on Wednesday that state authorities would begin to look at some of the backlog of untested rape kits in the state's crime lab. That announcement comes as the State Department of Justice received criticism on how the state has handled that criminal evidence.
Robert Menser joins us now, as he does every Friday, to break down this and other top news from the past week. He's a storytelling editor with USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hello, thanks.
Well, in the past year, Wisconsin got some federal grant money to start testing this backlog of rape kits. How is Wisconsin doing?
Yeah, they didn't do it. They took the, they got the money and they haven't done the testing. So it's a little more complicated than that. They're going to get started. But this came after, you know, this response only came after some more pressure from our investigative reporter at USA Today Network Wisconsin, Keegan Kyle, who first looked into this in 2014, found that there were more than 6,000 untested rape kits sitting in police storage. Wisconsin is not the only state that has this backlog, but there is evidence that suggests that Wisconsin is doing worse than many other states, has a larger backlog. So after this initial report came out, the Department of Justice announced $79 million in grants to test these kits. Wisconsin got $2 million specifically for testing, another $2 million for some investigations. That was a year ago. And what has happened since then is DOJ took months to develop a survey about untested evidence that they sent to police departments. And then many of the police agencies apparently are taking months to fill out and respond to that survey. So nothing really has started.
So the idea from the DOJ then has been that they wanted to survey everything before they began the testing. Is that still something they're trying to wait for before they start testing?
Well, so there are some actual issues or some questions here. Okay, so for example, there are times when rape kit testing is not necessarily required in order to get a conviction in the case. So in that case, they may not perform the tests, and they would keep the kits in case there were appeals in those criminal cases. There may also be departments that didn't respond because they don't have any kit, they have no backlog. So there are some, you know, reasons to find out what's going on. Another one, just to make sure we're sort of covering the waterfront here. Another thing that may cause this is if a victim chooses not to go forward with charges, that kit may not be tested, though there are advocates who say that they should be tested in all cases in order to sort of build a database of people who are committing rapes. But that may be a reason. So, okay, so these are valid questions, or at least these are questions that ought to be answered. The Department of Justice has a right to try to find the answers to these. But the question really is, why is it over a year at this point? And I think that a lot of people, including Senator Tammy Baldwin, came out and was quite critical of this, and that this week prompted the State Attorney General Schimmel to say that they would sort of move this along, put this on the front burner, and show progress on this.
So once these kits get tested, now we're talking about the ones that should be tested, not the ones you were just talking about, the idea is then that the DNA gets tested against a database, right, to see if there's any sort of matches that could lead to a conviction, maybe.
Right, well, so, right, yeah, we should say, a rape kit is, it's a collection of physical DNA evidence collected from a person who says that he or she, usually she, has been sexually assaulted. So a nurse will take the evidence at the time of the exam, and it's an intrusive, I mean, it's not a fun process, right? These are people who have been through trauma, and they have to go through this in order to ensure that there is evidence to build the legal case against their rapist. So it's important, but it comes at some cost. And so what is especially enraging in this case is to think that women have gone through this, and then the information isn't getting used.
And we'll be watching that one as that story develops, and I know you will too, Robert. And we're going to move on to talk about some tensions now. Well, between cranberry growers, I guess the elk aren't tense about it, but with conservationists, there's some concerns that maybe Wisconsin's elk herd, which is being built right now, is having some impact on the cranberry crop. What's happening?
Yes. So, yeah, elk versus cranberries, or cranberry growers versus elk. You know, elk were overhunted in Wisconsin, basically wiped out as a population in Wisconsin back in the late 1800s. And so for relatively recently, in the past 20 years or so, the State Department of Natural Resources has been reintroducing wild elk into the state. They have a deal with Kentucky to ship in a bunch of elk and every year and release some. And in July, 50 wild elk were released in the area of Black River Falls. There are hardly any there now, but biologists say that that part of the state could support as many as 400 herd as many as 400 elk. So this is great. Yeah, there's more biodiversity. There's more wild animals. These are interesting. They're these giant creatures. But the problem is they've been known to tramp through cranberry beds just before harvest time. They're destroying cranberries, or at least there's a thought that they could. So this week, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had a report on the conflict. The DNR, for its part, is trying to head off the worries of the cranberry growers. They spent $250,000 to build a bunch of fences around the farms in that area.
Rob is with us now, Rob Menser, looking at the latest and top news from Wisconsin, and we're going to continue this conversation in just a few minutes.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our discussion now with Rob Menser from the USA Today Network about the top news from the last week. And Rob, we left off talking about concerns from some cranberry growers in Wisconsin that elk might be endangering their crop by trampling them. Apparently, elk can be about 800 pounds. Which is a big animal. The DNR built some fences. And I wonder where that debate stands right now. Is there sort of a brokered peace at the moment?
There is at the moment. And it should be said that there really hasn't been that much actual damage reported this year. It's more the sense of potential damage if the herd grows. So it could just be that cranberry growers are nervous about it. But it's the sort of issue that the DNR does need to face as they reintroduce these species.
And we're going to move on and talk about our next breaking news story from this week. On Tuesday, conservative talk radio host from southeastern Wisconsin, Charlie Sykes, announced that he would retire at the end of the year. And here's a little bit of what he had to say.
I am not saying goodbye. I am intending to continue to be an active and independent voice. But I'm just not going to be setting the alarm at 4:15 a.m. We just informed the staff that after 23 years of doing this daily radio show here at WTMJ, I'm going to be stepping back at the end of this year.
The timing is interesting on this. Sykes says there's nothing to the timing, that he was already planning this. But, I mean, Charlie Sykes has been really instrumental, I think, in shaping opinions in southeastern Wisconsin, especially this year around Donald Trump and the Republican Party. And, you know, he hasn't always been in step with other Republicans. What do you make of this news?
Yeah, so Charlie Sykes, as a conservative talk show host in Wisconsin, has had a good run of a few years here. As in the Governor Scott Walker era, I think it's been very good to Charlie Sykes and the turn towards a more conservative politics in Wisconsin. His show, I mean, he's a movement conservative guy. He's happy to, you know, sort of drum up outrage in his audience, and he brings conservative politicians on his show to talk about new, you know, to announce news or to spin. But yeah, at the same time, he has this pragmatic side to him. He's this year has been heavily a never Trump guy, really a key figure in the opposition to Donald Trump in the presidential primaries in Wisconsin, and won significantly, unlike his elected Republicans in Wisconsin, who has stuck with that position, who is he characterizes himself as a hard never Trump guy. He is not coming around. So he's happy to bash Hillary Clinton all day as well. But he's spent significant amount of time as bashing Trump, and for sure he has listeners in this presidential cycle who think he's wrong and resent that decision. But yeah, you're right. He says that's not what's driving it, and that very well may be the case. But it's interesting, and it's an interesting question whether the talk radio, sort of conservative talk radio figures who fill his you know, take his spot or try to step into that role, would have the same kind of, you know, he had the ability to be a little bit adversarial with even his own audience sometimes.
Do we have any idea what comes next for Charlie Sykes?
Well, so he writes. He edits a conservative publication in Wisconsin, and he has a book coming out that is, I guess, the working title is How the Right Lost Its Mind, that sounds like it's going to be pretty interesting and critical of some of his conservative talk radio colleagues, I would read it. That sounds interesting to me. So he speaks about wanting, you know, having an interest in writing and other types of communication. He's still going to go on MSNBC, perhaps. He's been done some TV work. And there was like a little tiny bit of speculation right after the announcement that maybe he'd run for Senate, challenge Tammy Baldwin for Senate, but he tamped that down pretty quick. I think he was pretty Sherman-esque in his denial that was his plan.
And one last story for us, Rob. Early next week, a federal judge is going to consider a request to suspend Wisconsin's voter ID law, or maybe just look at some tweaks to the law after an investigation found that there may have been some inaccurate information given out at the DMV. What is the story there?
Right. So just today, Governor Scott Walker said that a check by the State Department of Justice found some concerns. These checks happened as a direct result of a judge's order that Wisconsin performed this because the DMV offices, they're not issuing voting IDs according to the law. Part of having a voter ID law in Wisconsin is that if you are somebody in Wisconsin who needs an ID in order to vote, you should be able to get that for free. And the way the law is set up and the way that the judge has ordered, you're supposed to get it promptly while you enter into like a petition process. And so what some investigations have found, and now the Department of Justice's own investigation have found, is that those rules are not being followed, or at least not uniformly across the state. Sometimes people are being told, well, you might have to wait, or you might have to you won't get it today, you won't get it right away. And that's not what the law is. So, next week on October 12th, this judge will consider a request from the Liberal One Wisconsin Institute to actually block the law for this coming election. Now, typically judges don't get in the middle of, you know, a hot political issue this close to the election. But on the other hand, I guess it'll be interesting to see what the report that Walker administration produced found, and what how the judge feels that was conducted.
And that's another one to keep an eye on. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That was Rob Menser, storytelling editor with the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And he joins us every Friday to talk about this week's top state news stories in Wisconsin.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. According to new research, frugality can be really expensive. For example, buying in bulk can save you money in the long term. But for people with lower incomes, buying in bulk may be out of the question.
In a new study, our next guest tried to see how big an impact that has on household budgets for low-income families. Joining us now is Mike Palazzolo. He's a marketing professor at the University of California, Davis. He's the co-author of a study that looks at this issue. It's called Frugality is Hard to Afford. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start. I know the research is looking at bigger picture stuff, but let's talk about what you found out when you looked at frugality and toilet paper in particular. What kind of things did you find?
So we were looking primarily at how lack of liquidity might impede low-income households from being able to engage in intertemporal substitution to save money. And what I mean by that is, if you think about when you go to the supermarket and you see, say, something on sale, you may not need it right now, but if it's cheaper than it would be a week from now when you would need it, for many of us it's very trivial to just go ahead and make that purchase at this moment, or alternatively to buy a 36-pack of toilet paper at Costco. But for low-income households, because they don't have, you know, an infinite supply of cash to just throw around, they have to make much more difficult choices about where they spend it, and are prohibited sometimes, or at least inhibited, from engaging in these behaviors. And we look specifically at the toilet paper category and show that this is the case.
Right. I think anybody who pays attention when they're shopping knows the larger the pack of toilet paper you get, the cheaper it is per unit. So if somebody can only afford that one roll or four pack at a time, over the course of a year, they're going to be paying a lot more than someone who can buy it, as you say, in bulk at Costco or the grocery store.
Indeed. In fact, we checked, we compared their behavior, the behavior of the lowest income quintile in the U.S., to the highest income quintile. And based on their toilet paper purchase habits, we found that we would expect that the lowest income households would pay about 5.9% more per sheet of toilet paper due to their inability to buy in bulk and buy on sale as often as higher income households.
And it's not just that liquidity issue you mentioned of how much money do you have in your wallet right now. You also raise issues of transportation. If you have to take the bus to the grocery store, can you buy that big pack?
Indeed, yes. So there's transportation. There are storage constraints. So often, naturally, lower income households are more likely renting or may live in a smaller house where there's less storage space. So there are a number of other factors. Not all of it is covered in our research, but other researchers have found strong effects in particular of storage constraints. We find that even after controlling for all of these other things to the best of our ability, there's still an effect of liquidity constraints above and beyond it. So that 5.9% number I mentioned before, how much more low-income households are paying for toilet paper, that's actually probably a lower bound because that's even after controlling for these other factors.
We've been talking about toilet paper, and that adds up, as you say, over the course of the year. What happens when we start saying toilet paper and cans of soup and cans of green beans or whatever, all the other products that exactly the same rule is going to apply to?
Well, so that's actually a much trickier question to answer, and it's one reason why we tried to stick with one category, specifically one category that isn't food-based. So there's some other research that indicates that households, regardless of income level, if they have more of something on hand, they are more likely to consume it faster. So if you imagine you're having dinner and you have a 24-pack of Coke sitting in your pantry as opposed to a 6-pack, you might say, oh, well, I could have a Coke tonight. I have a bunch sitting there. I might as well just drink it. And so perhaps one next step for our field to take is to start looking across a bunch of different categories and start trying to develop some theories as to what solutions might work here that wouldn't have detrimental consequences. So you can imagine we've suggested that some of these problems we've highlighted are due to liquidity constraints, among other things. If we were to relax liquidity constraints, provide low-income households with the ability to borrow a little more easily, it could very well help them save money in categories like toilet paper, but it could potentially lead to health consequences if they're consuming more soda.
We're talking to Mike Palazzolo, marketing professor at the University of California, Davis, looking at the sometimes high cost of being frugal. Well, let's talk about that idea. It is, ironically, I guess, more expensive to live in this country if you're low income, if you're in poverty.
Indeed, and for many reasons. One we haven't talked about so much just yet, but that is alluded to briefly in our paper and studied by others, is this concept of redlining. Where some stores aren't available within low-income households. And above and beyond that, some research has found that actually even when stores are available in low-income neighborhoods, stores like Walmart or perhaps I shouldn't use exact names because it's not store-specific, but they may face higher prices within their low-income neighborhoods.
Do we know why that is?
So there's some conflict within the research about whether the effects found with respect to this are due to maybe because it's harder to get product there because some of these neighborhoods may be a little more isolated. There are fewer stores. It may be due to a lack of competition because there are fewer stores competing for these consumers in that location. It may be higher retail costs for renting a location if we're talking about big cities. That area of research isn't one I'm an expert in, but there are a number of different reasons that are being considered for why this might be the case.
A lot of times I think we see financial advice targeted at poor people and almost like chastising them for not being frugal enough, for not being careful with their money. It sounds like from what you're saying from your own research and some of the other things you've cited that even if you're poor and you want to be frugal, there are a lot of built-in obstacles.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, what you've just touched on is, I think, one of the big areas of interest within the social sciences. There's a lot of disagreement about the degree to which low-income households may be just prohibited from doing the smart thing, and the degree to which perhaps their circumstances have made it very difficult for them to actually do the smart thing, even if they are able to do so. And so we found, as you mentioned, at least some evidence that they know the right thing to do, at least within some circumstances, but are limited from their ability to do it due to liquidity constraints.
Well, let's get back to solutions. You were starting to talk about that a little, and you mentioned the idea of easier access to borrowing to make it possible to, say, stock up on that item and save money. When we think of lending and borrowing in low-income neighborhoods, though, we're often talking about very high-interest, payday loans, car title loans, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
What would you like to see available as an alternative?
So I'm going to sort of take a step back here and say I don't know that I want to claim right now that I see a clear alternative, simply because for the reasons I mentioned before, where we've seen some research indicating that buying in bulk can potentially lead to greater consumption. I don't know if the research has come to a strong conclusion on this, and I don't want to make a claim that isn't backed up by evidence. But I can say that the evidence does seem to indicate that the kind of loans available to these low-income households currently is insufficient, and we do need to find another solution. And that's probably a very important next step for us to start thinking about.
How about to access to savings? Costco, there's an upfront cost. Low-income person may not be able to afford that. As you mentioned, they may have no stores that'll provide items in bulk, or maybe only one store, and there's no competition. Is there talk of anything we could do to, get rid of those bargain deserts, if I can make up a phrase?
It's interesting. Michelle Obama has pushed the concept of food deserts, which I think is what you're riffing on. And efforts to push greater access to healthier foods may, just as a consequence of having access in general via stores, help these sorts of problems as well. It's not what's been focused on in the press, but if access is increased to different types of stores, this may be helped just in the way that access to greater foods can be helped.
Apart from maybe borrowing being an option, maybe more access to stores, are there any other solution-oriented ideas that you're looking at, either in the paper we're talking about or in future research?
So I will say that I personally am not looking at this, but a lot of people are, and I think it's a really interesting topic that I may get into soon. But there's this idea that low-income households are harmed not just by liquidity constraints, not having enough cash on hand, but by income volatility, which at certain times of the year makes them extraordinarily constrained. You can imagine that at times where you're extraordinarily constrained as opposed to a little constrained, that relationship between what you're able to do and your purchasing power may not be exactly linear. And it can cause severe damage to low-income households' ability to save, ability to, say, get their car fixed and go on job interviews. So one solution that's been batted around is trying to find ways to simply decrease the volatility for low-income households, irrespective of their total annual earnings. And there are a number of ways that this can happen. Employers can try and just provide steadier hours for their workers, even if they're not changing the number of hours in total. There's been some talk, and I'm not an expert on government programs, but there's been some talk of trying to provide, insurance so that during lower-earning times, low-income households can have a little bit of assistance. So anything that can potentially help prevent low-income households from dipping down so low in terms of their liquidity that they're basically inhibited from doing anything can be very, very helpful.
So that volatility might be you work at a store, there's more hours available in the holiday season or something like that?
Exactly. Or even more extreme, you could be someone who has to bounce from job to job, and during the holiday season it's easy to find work, and during the summer maybe it's easy to find work, but around February maybe it's very difficult. And so you have virtually no income in February and a lot more during the summer or around Christmas.
So what is your next step in researching these issues?
So my next step actually is under discussion right now with my co-author, Yesha Morhoon. We've talked about a couple of things, but I don't know that I'm at this stage I want to discuss them because we haven't had a chance to think them through carefully. And as any good academic, I don't want to say something without evidence first. But we're looking, broadly speaking, at this, I don't know that I would call it movement, but there's been a lot of discussion about the minimum wage recently, and specifically whether maybe possibly reducing the degree to which certain types of employees are dependent upon tipping. And so that's an area, broadly speaking, that we want to take a look at. I don't know that we have any strong theories yet that are supported by evidence that I can report to you, but it's an area that's getting more discussion and one I think is interesting and worth taking a look at.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mike Palazzolo is a marketing professor at the University of California, Davis, co-researcher for the report, Frugality is Hard to Afford.